Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, Betsy Bonner, author of the book of Atlantis Black.
Hi, Donna. Thanks for having me.
Could you give us an idea of what the book of Atlantis Black is?
This is a memoir about my sister's disappearance in Tijuana and what appeared to be her mysterious death in Mexico. It's my own investigation as her sister. So I was 2 years younger than my sister Atlantis, my sister Eunice Ann Bonner, who changed her name to Atlantis Black. And she was 31 when she disappeared. That was in the year 2008. So I spent 7 years writing this memoir. And it's a combination of archival work. I had access to her email account, social media account. It's really a record of my relationship with her, my tracking of her as best I could. I was with her 11 days before she was gone, and I was receiving messages from her after she was gone. And it's really an unresolved, it has an unresolved ending, because there are things that my family still doesn't know.
What family there is left?
Well, good point. Yeah, so the characters in this book who are still alive, my Aunt Tina, who was my mother's sister, and my cousin Elizabeth. So we as a group with my mother went down to San Diego, and three of us went to Tijuana to identify Atlantis. And the big problem I had was that my mother identified her body in person and then said that it wasn't her. So my mother had bipolar disorder, and what I understood was either she was having her own nervous breakdown, or she might have been trying to protect me from something. I wasn't sure. I do believe my sister's dead. I think I should get that out there. I believe that, but I don't believe we have all of the information about what happened. And I definitely know before she disappeared, she was talking about faking her own death, which is something through friends I know that you know something about, Donna. So I was prepared for my sister to run away to Mexico. She was fleeing this court case, a prescription drug court case in the state of California. And she felt that her life was threatened. She believed her life was threatened, whether or not it really was. The important thing is that she believed that. There were 12 felony counts for these, I guess it was Vicodin, prescription opioids. And it wasn't clear to me that my sister, it seemed like she was involved in at least one crime, but she didn't do it alone. And she refused to name the person who did it with her. But it also wasn't the crime, like none of that was even the point. The point was my sister became really obsessed with the idea of running away, faking her death. And she told me a lot about it until she stopped talking about it. And I know she was keeping secrets from me by the end of her time in this country.
And in order to sort of pick apart and find out what happened to her, you take us back to the beginnings of the story, which is the beginnings of you guys, of you and your sister, of your relationship, of you seem to have been tracking her all your life.
Yeah, that's a wonderful observation. And it's absolutely true. So she was my only sister. And the fact that she was in this world before I entered it meant, it actually meant everything to me. Our mother, as I mentioned, had bipolar disorder. Our mother had tried to kill herself when I was 2 and my sister was 4. I didn't remember this, but my sister did have a memory of it. Our father was physically abusive. That's something that was through his line in an Irish Catholic family. And I really trusted my sister to be the person to tell me how to live, you know? So I was tracking her, following her. She wasn't always, you know, she certainly wasn't maternal, but she could be protective. So sometimes, you know, we sparred, she would try to kill me. I was actually scared, you know, because she would chase me with a knife. But then as we became adults, I would see her on stage. She became a musician, and she had some cult level success in New York City. So I would literally see her on stage, which is where she was happiest. And I was happier being quieter, being more introverted, being a writer. And I would also add, in writing the memoir, there were times I did a lot more of autobiographical writing about me. And in shaping this, I just cut those sections because the book is, it's very much about my sister. I couldn't have this material if not for her. She wouldn't have this book written about her if not for me. So yeah, it's kind of hybrid. It's a memoir, but it's kind of hybrid biography with a little bit of investigative reporting.
You described her as sort of your canary in the coal mine going before you.
My canary in the dark. That's right.
And in a family where the parents are very, you know, it's sort of you grow up in a crisis situation.
Right.
And she, in a lot of ways, took the heat.
That's right.
For you, and was incredibly damaged by it. I think you both were. But she is the ultimate red herring. I mean, she's slippery from the very beginning.
Oh, yes. You cannot trust Atlantis. Atlantis loved nothing more than having secrets. She had a hidden part of herself always. And I would get to hear little bits of things, secret crushes, secret relationships, you know, but it's what made her feel alive was to have secrets. So yes, I could count on that. I could count on slipperiness and on not knowing everything from the beginning.
Well, and also that's, I mean, some measure of power that she retained over herself.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that's so true. I mean, it's the one way in which everything is resolved for me, because it makes perfect sense, though things escalated, you know, in her wanting to be hidden.
Okay, before we get further into that, I think this is a great place to read a bit and hear a bit of the book from you.
Thank you. So this comes from part one. This is chapter 6. And my sister has changed her name to Atlantis Black. She's moved out to Los Angeles and she's coming home. During Atlantis's first semester at Loyola, she'd found work as a waitress at a strip club. In her second semester, she dropped out and moved to Los Angeles. College wasn't very interesting, she said, and she wanted to focus on making music. I was worried when she told me that she'd taken yet another name, Roxanne, for a phone sex job, but she said it was the easiest money she'd ever made in her life and that none of the girls took it seriously. In my last month of senior year, Atlantis called from a payphone in Albuquerque and said she was on her way home. She'd had it with Los Angeles. She'd yelled at a guy who was getting disgusting on the phone and told him she was a 300-pound lesbian and that he must have a tiny dick. She'd pawned everything she could and would be home in 3 days. She needed a free place to live and hoped to earn some quick cash in Chatsworth Ford before moving to New York. 3 days later, I came home from school, saw the Alpha in the driveway, and found Atlantis sacked out in the living room with a Cybill Shepherd movie on the TV. In the year and a half since we'd seen each other, she'd grown her hair to her waist. She wore the same heavy eyeliner and mascara whose application she'd perfected in high school, but no foundation, blush, or lipstick, just a thin dusting of powder. She was still enviably thin. "You look good," I said. "It's the desert," she said. "You have to go there. The dry heat is amazing, actually clears up your skin. Though of all the places I've been, you'd love Northern California. You applied to Stanford, right?" "I'm going to Sarah Lawrence," I said. "They offered me a small scholarship." "What, are you a dyke now?" she said. "Oh, I have something for you." The laminated card she put in my hand said Atlantis Black was born in 1974, 2 years before her actual birth, and had black hair and brown eyes. The photograph showed her tilting her head down to hide the Irish double chin she'd inherited from our father. She no longer needed that particular ID, she said, and I could use it if I ever wanted to go out in Philadelphia or New York. I shouldn't worry about the eye color, which was a mistake anyway, because no one ever checked in the dark. We still looked alike, mostly because of our long dark hair, which we wore loose down our backs. I told her I didn't care about bars and certainly didn't want to get caught sneaking into one. It must be nice to be so straight, she said. You better keep it just in case. She talked her way into a telemarketing job, which earned her more money than most 19-year-olds made in our town. I had no idea how she spent her time when she wasn't at work until I came home one afternoon and caught her at the living room window, peering through binoculars at one of our new neighbors, a 14-year-old girl next door. The girl next door was in her yard by the wading pool, playing with her kid sister. Like a little mother, she lifted her sister up and out of the water and then dunked her back in. We lived close enough to hear their screen door open and close, and when their mom came out in chino shorts, carrying a tray of snacks and lemonade, I saw Atlantis's body tense. I watched her watching their mom set the tray by the pool's edge and open her arms to the child in the water. The girl next door threw a towel in their direction and curled into a sagging lawn chair with a Delia's catalog. Do you think she's straight? My sister said. They are all straight, I said. She has wicked thighs, she said. She is in eighth grade, I said, on the cusp of teenage dreams. Doesn't their mom look exactly like Lana Turner in The Postman Always Rings Twice? In an attempt to distract ourselves from the humidity, we'd been staying up late watching the Bravo Network. I sneaked a peek at their mom's long tanned legs myself. You didn't even know who Lana Turner was until I told you. What color do you think her eyes are? My sister said. Don't know. Brown hair, brown eyes, I guess. Wrong. She has black eyes. There's no such thing, I said. At her age, I was getting drunk and having sex with those assholes in the Burger King parking lot, Atlanta said. I can't believe her mom lets her wear hot pants to school. I tossed my sassy magazine on the coffee table. I'm going to write her a letter, she said, something from the wolf to make her wet. Lately, she had become fixated on some entity that possessed her, which she called the beast or the wolf. She'll think it's from a guy, I said. Duh, she picked up her guitar. I'll address it to her soul.
Forever frozen. Stop my heart, 1994.
It also occurred to me that along with your own anguish at your sister's demise, that what the outside world saw and who you knew didn't match up in value.
Oh, of course not.
And that telling her story from the beginning reclaims her and rehumanizes her.
That's a lovely way of putting it, rehumanizes. Yeah, I mean, on the outside, it looked like here was some kind of junkie who had mental health issues, who was working as a pharmacy technician, who'd failed in her music career, couldn't finish her second album, couldn't keep it together with her partner, was living with roommates, you know, people who met her after she left New York I don't think found her very impressive at all. You know, it's her prime was when she was in her 20s in New York. And then it's a combination of, you know, really bad luck, certainly. But I really do think that mental illness and the early traumas that she was never able to get past. She tried EMDR therapy and became obsessed with her therapist. Even her therapist ended up dropping her. In order to, you know, to make anyone care, it was important to show her as a child, to show her as Nancy, and to show her when she really did have promise. So one friend of hers who's a documentary filmmaker, a successful one, Remy Weber, who'd casually played in a band with her, said she did a lot with very little. And I think that's true.
I see your upbringing struck me as taking place sort of further back in time than one would think. I mean, it's sort of religious and isolated and backward in a way that one wouldn't have thought at the time it should be.
So Chadsford, Pennsylvania, that's where much of the beginning of the book is set before we moved to New York. At the time, it was more of the sticks than the suburb of Philadelphia that it is now. And I describe, there are rich people who have horse farms and other kinds of farms, and then there are working class people. And I attribute a lot of the backwardness both to being in the sticks, and then my father really seemed like he came. He was born in 1936. He was older anyway. My mother was born in 1942. So he looked like he was in the 1950s, even in the 1980s. He used the pomade, you know, for his hair. He wore these kind of thick 1950s glasses. And the Catholicism, I mean, that's, it was, I think I didn't mention it in the memoir, he was thinking about becoming a missionary before he met my mother. So they met, he kind of went to the army, was in the Korean War, as he put it, after peace was made, but as we know, that's all kind of nebulous. But I think something happened to him in the army that he never really, he wasn't someone who talked about bullying or being abused too much, but he did tell us some stories about, I guess he was made fun of for being a Catholic when he was growing up in school. And his response was to, you know, save up. He hid under the stairs and like beat the shit out of someone who'd, you know, bullied him in the past. And that was his survival and his own rage. So there was a lot of backwardness in just my father's background and then combined with the place that Chadsford really was, which was almost completely white. A lot of, again, there were just the few people who were very wealthy, even they, I mean, they were, not, it's not that that bred culture, you know? And then there were a lot of people who used hunting, you know, to get food on their table.
And that combined with your mom's mental illness.
But not to forget, don't be rude, Donna. I'm totally kidding. My mother, in fact, was advanced. So she was reading Silent Spring. She ended up being a Green Party. She ran for the Green Party with the Green Party for a representative position. She was extremely liberal. And she made more money than my father before she had a kind of breakdown at DuPont. So she had a PhD in communications. She was advanced, and then yes, intellectually she was advanced. Emotionally, she suffered from all sorts of things, but certainly the bipolar disorder when the depression took over her mind. She couldn't be very advanced at all. You know, she would have to be in bed. When she was manic, that's when she met my father. You know, I mean, she could be very charming and exciting to be around. So yeah, they're those two extremes. I mean, it's the more extreme of the bipolar disorder that my mother had. And my father had never known anything like that. He didn't even believe that she had mental illness. He didn't know what it was. He was ashamed to take anyone to a psychiatrist, you know, and he accused her later on, after she tried to kill herself, for example, he accused her, you know, you hid all this from me. And it's like, hey, brother,
you know, you duped me. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's funny because you and your sister, I mean, my siblings and I can be pretty much competitive about anything. Mm-hmm. And there was one, I mean, it's hard to say funny. It's hard to say sad. It's all what it is. But there's a couple of examples where, you know, your mother and Atlantis sort of, well, we have mental illness, so we're better than you. You know what I mean? It's like, well, what do you have? You know, it struck me as like, it's any family. You use what you have, you know, doesn't matter what it is, you know.
Oh, you are so right. You are so right. And to pick up on that is so funny. I'm glad that worked. Yeah, I mean, it's the two of them sharing a bed, talking about their suicide attempts. You know, they were the cool kids, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
You haven't even slit a wrist. You know, who are you?
You know? What kind of person are you?
Yeah, exactly. You're so boring.
You know? Do you even feel anything? Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And that competitive, like, obviously I feel so much more.
I can't take it anymore. Sick of waking on the floor. Come and take it, walk with me. See how red the sky can be. Yeah, well, sometimes hurts. I should have known you'd never stay. I can't kill myself today. I have bills to pay. I can't kill myself today. No.
Okay, here's a question for you. Would your sister have wanted you to write the book?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Really, she didn't think me capable of doing it. So she tasked her friend who'd written for Bust Magazine and some places, a really cool, lovely human being named Colleen Kane. But she tasked Colleen with writing the book. So it's called The Book of Atlantis Black because my sister fantasized that someone would write a book about her, mm-hmm. but I wouldn't have been the one. But anyway, she would have been happy with what I came up with, mostly because it's had a great reception and a lot of people are reading about her. You know, yeah. I've wondered that too. Like, well, what about when I'm, you know, when I'm revealing some of her darkness? I think I even wrote it in the style, Donna, that she would have liked. You know, she would have liked this kind of mystery thriller page turner. I mean, there are aspects of that that would have pleased my sister and my mother, who liked Agatha Christie, would have pleased them.
And I mean, Atlantis does get to have the last word, you know. She
gets the last word and all the best lines.
And this has been a transformation for you.
You're absolutely right about this book being written in response to my mother's death. My mother committed suicide 5 months after Atlantis's disappearance and presumed death. Again, I believe she's dead. There were pieces of paper that were forged. There was weirdness, right? And that's part of what I was looking into. And I had to, you know, I had to get over the idea of like blaming my mother, my sister for my mother's death, blaming my mother for my sister's death. I mean, the two of them, my mother who wouldn't bail Atlantis out of jail. Then she had a grand mal seizure in the detention center, you know, didn't have her meds. So of course she was off her rocker by the time she was released. And it's weird that this stuff happens in America all the time. People who are on medications are deprived of them. They get different medications in jail. Oh, it's just, you know, and the secrecy around that. No one even told me my sister was in jail. I was living in Greece. No one told me until the day she was getting out, my aunt told me against my mother's wishes, because my mother knew if I knew, I would have flown back to America and gotten her out somehow.
She was a person, as we were saying before, that a lot of people could dismiss. So I think, you know, a lot of the mysteries were due to just indifference and incompetence, because in their eyes, she didn't matter so much. She was someone to be processed through.
Correct.
Part of the mystery is the mystery of social media as well.
I completely agree. And I think she was an early user of the internet. Mm-hmm. So there was a time when musicians and drug dealers and all sorts of people, you know, used MySpace, of course, Craigslist. And yeah, I had invited her to Facebook because I was leaving to live in Greece. And I thought, so again, it was 2007 when I was leaving. So I invited her to that social network. And she didn't have a lot of friends on it, but she used it, as you're saying, and every one of her associates seemed to have her password at some time. So it could have been multiple people posting on her behalf. She was good, very interested in creating this persona of a desperate woman, you know, but then also a desperate woman who doesn't give a fuck, right? And then she goes missing and nobody looks for her. You know, my mother never filed a report of the death of American abroad, said she didn't need it. You know, she tells us she's going to run away. Like, no. So she creates, in a way, this persona of being a loser, but also someone who could have been perceived as dangerous because she didn't care. It's the photographs. I mean, the other thing about her, she was physically beautiful. There was a time when she was physically beautiful, and other people made sure about documenting that. So people are, you know, taking, you know, video of her, video that seems kind of like it could be something to do with extortion or kidnapping. It's, you know, crazy stuff, but then she seems cheerful in it, you know, and it's very hard to know when she's like at all revealing what's actually going on. And on that level, I thought that my own memories were more reliable than any of this archival stuff. You know, any of these Facebook posts, any of these emails, they could have been written by anyone, posted by anyone. I knew that. She also allowed that to happen, you know. And the idea of identity was very interesting to her. The idea of sharing ID cards, not having one's own identity. She didn't, society didn't show her that she mattered, so why should she care about societal rules, you know? So yeah, her anger never left her. Her anger was her source of energy.
And I would say your source of energy, which is so palpable through this book, was your love of her.
Oh, thank you for saying that. I mean, it's love and rage. I was enraged by my mother's death. I was heartbroken when Atlantis was gone. And then with my mother, it's not even really true. I think I was heartbroken after my mother was gone. And then a couple of years later, experienced the rage. What the hell happened? She never should have died. My mother, you know, she only died because of what happened to my sister.
I'm so glad we haven't revealed a lot of the ins and outs, because you so skillfully take us through this physical journey and this emotional roller coaster ride and this literally just cryptic tale. It really combines all of those qualities. And so I would highly recommend the book of Atlantis Black. And it's out now. It's by Betsy Bonner and it's published by Tin House Books. Betsy, thank you so much for coming on Radio Gorgeous.
Donna, thank you for having me.